I'm Amber Duke.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Eno Stepman.
And I'm Will Chamber.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We have a lot of lawfare topics today, but also some fun things kicking around through Congress. We're going to start actually with me going through Robert Herr's testimony yesterday on his report into Biden's mishandling of classified documents. Then we'll go to Ben, who will cover a bit of Barry Loudermilk's report on the January 6th committee and all of the things they either left out or got wrong. Then over to Will to talk about the potential ban of TikTok, or at least the decoupling of it from its Chinese parent company. And then finally, Inez will talk about how DEI could be the downfall of one of Biden's most celebrated accomplishments, in his words, which is the CHIPS Act. So I'll go ahead and start with my topic, which is this Robert Herr testimony that we saw yesterday in front of the House Judiciary Committee. And he was testifying, of course, about his report into Biden's mishandling of classified documents. This is something that Biden actually interviewed with the DOJ for back in the fall, actually on October 8th, the day after the attacks on Israel by Hamas, the terror attack on Israel by Hamas. And coincidentally, on the same day that Robert Herr showed up on Capitol Hill to testify, the DOJ decided to release the transcript of Biden's interview to Congress, which of course immediately was leaked to the media. And we got to get a very inside glimpse of just exactly why Robert Herr reached the conclusion that even though Biden had willfully retained classified information and shared it with others, that he did not think he could secure a conviction in front of a jury. And it was because of Biden's mental incapacities. We saw that the Biden White House had apparently lied, and Biden himself lied about the idea that it was Robert Herr who asked Biden about his dead son, Beau Biden. And that was one of the instances that Herr highlighted in his report as evidence that Biden's memory is failing, because he supposedly could not remember even within a few years when his son died. We can now see in the transcript that it was actually Joe Biden himself who brought up his son's death first in response to a question about classified documents at his home in Virginia in the time period of 2017 to 2018. After hearing 2017 to 2018, Joe Biden says, "I believe that was around the time my son was deployed or dying." His son actually died in 2015, so some years earlier. And he is quickly corrected on that point by a staff member in the transcript. There's also some weird meandering stuff about cars and his Corvette, where he starts talking to Robert Herr about how cool it is to go down his driveway in his fast car. The transcript even includes, in parentheses, car noises. So apparently Biden decided to say vroom vroom to the special counsel. And then in another section that was quite interesting, he said to the DOJ agents who he believes were charged with going through his Wilmington, Delaware home, that they probably stumbled across some risque photos of his wife, Jill, in her bathing suit because she's such a beautiful woman. So just some really weird stuff. And he repeatedly forgot what the word for fax machine was. So this this transcript drops, we get to see all of the details corroborated from the Herr report. And then Herr, of course, gives his testimony to Congress, where he repeatedly kicks Democrats for trying to twist the words and manipulate what was actually said in the report. They kept trying to use the word exonerate or clear, to which Robert Herr responded quite aggressively, I guess you could say, as aggressively as a DOJ special counsel might, that the report in no way exonerates Joe Biden, that the evidence shows that he did have willful retention. The evidence shows that Biden shared classified information with his ghostwriter that he knew was probably classified, and also that the ghostwriter was involved in the destruction of evidence because he moved audio files of Biden sharing classified information with him to his computer recycling bin after he found out that a special counsel was appointed to investigate this case. The rub was that he did not feel he could secure a conviction, but of course that's not an exoneration, it's not a clearing. And so it was a pretty bad day for the Democrats, a pretty bad day for the Biden White House. The White House responded by having their favorite errand boy, Ann Sams, come out and again claim that the report cleared Joe Biden, that it didn't show any evidence of wrongdoing, and then attacked Robert Hur and his character, as quite a few Democrats did, basically trying to suggest that he was covering for Donald Trump and going after Joe Biden for political reasons. So all of this basically just confirmed what the top lines were out of the report itself when it came out about a month ago. And again, a really bad day for Democrats because it really laid bare all of the issues that Biden had with his retention of classified documents, especially since he was a senator and vice president, not a president at the time, with the authority to declassify. Probably shouldn't have had these documents in the first place. And then a lot of the comparisons to the Trump case, I think, fell flat yesterday as well during that testimony, particularly since Robert Hur was not charged with investigating that. There were some Republicans who took issue with the fact that Robert Hur sort of slipped out of prosecuting Joe Biden by bringing up these memory issues and tried to argue with him on that. But that was pretty much the extent of it. So I'll go ahead and kick it to the group, and y'all can share what you thought of Robert Hur's testimony as well.
I thought it was remarkable that you had, there was just one particular sequence I thought was remarkable, which was when I think it might've been Matt Gaetz or somebody else questioned her on different places where classified documents were found. And this idea that they were just strewn about the entirety of his house and his different nonprofits he had worked for. And obviously, I mean, I think the big difference, right, is the fact that he didn't have authority to have those classified documents, unlike President Trump, who, you know, as president, that classification authority flowed from him. That wasn't the case for Joe Biden when he was either senator or vice president. So it's just another way in which I think the cases against Trump are falling apart here. It's just a very, very obvious selective prosecution issue where you have the DOJ belonging to Joe Biden, who himself very, very badly mishandled classified, is trying to prosecute and put Trump in jail for mishandling classified.
I thought Ben would jump in there since I know that he knows more about all of these things than any of us, I think. No, I mean, I just want to underscore what Will said. This just highlights over and over again, leaving aside the issues with Biden's memory and the president going vroom vroom in these kinds of interactions. This just highlights once again the selective prosecution standard with Trump. Again, as Will said, the president has declassification authority. That entire bureaucracy around classifying documents, all of that flows through the president, which is why it's in some sense so absurd to talk about the president being essentially, and by the way, actually, there was an announcement this week that the intel services are not going to brief candidate Trump on some of these classified documents based on the idea that President Trump is some kind of unique threat to national security and classified documents. When we see from her testimony and just elsewhere, there have been so many cases of mishandled classified documents. Some of that is because of the fact that we have an overclassification issue, right? There are really, really important secret documents that are super classified. And then the equivalent of like somebody's cookie recipe is also classified, and we have that issue. But it just highlights that selective prosecution and double standard for Biden, who didn't even have the authority to declassify these documents, didn't even have the authority to remove these documents in many cases, especially as a senator, to remove them from where they were displayed in a secure location to senators. So again, that double standard.
Interestingly, Biden himself sort of raises a soft alibi about overclassification being an issue in the transcripts. And it's very clear, by the way, why the DOJ sat on the transcripts when you actually go through them and then, of course, dumps them in the lap of the members hours before this hearing. It's also clear why they're sitting on the tapes, because if you actually read the transcripts, as Amber alluded to, there are just some bizarre, very long asides, rambling Joe Biden has very precise memories about things that occurred supposedly 40 or 50 years ago, or at least memories of the lies that he's been telling for a long time about things that occurred decades ago, but can't tell you anything about, for example, him referencing to a ghostwriter the fact that he just found all the classified stuff in connection with the ghostwriting of this book. And then the ghostwriter, of course, goes and destroys the audio recording. But in any event, I think, you know, there are a couple big takeaways. Yes, Republicans were able to elicit the line from her that this report does not exonerate. Clearly, it does not. But by the same token, there's a pox on every house here because her, like Jim Comey, basically says, yes, crimes were committed, but no, I'm not going to bring them for XYZ reason. And look, it may well be that you could never secure a conviction of Joe Biden in Delaware or Washington, D.C. on any of myriad counts, but that's not the rationale that her gives. And so Democrats are kind of boxed from the perspective of either the president is cognitively impaired and thus he's not prosecuted, or he's very sharp and he should be prosecuted. They weren't really made to answer for that necessarily during the hearing, but it is worth saying. I do think, again, the tapes themselves would be devastating. A couple points. Matt Gaetz did raise a really important point. He asked basically, did her link the fact that these documents were very recklessly kept at places like the Penn Biden Center, where millions of dollars of Chinese funds have flown into Penn? Did you look at the security implications, the nexus between the documents, Chinese Communist Party money, Penn Biden Center? I don't think there was a question asked about whether Hunter Biden was interviewed in connection with the investigation, but shouldn't he have been, given that he was in close proximity to these documents and influence peddling? The last thing that Hearst should not be let off the hook about is on the timeline itself. There's a presentation here and a narrative that basically the Biden team found out about these documents. They were very forthcoming, brought them to the fore. And that's the difference between Trump, who was trying to obstruct, even though he was engaged in a substantial negotiations with NARA, who seemed to be colluding with DOJ, the National Archives. And they cooked up this case that he was trying to obstruct when actually there was a long negotiation. But Joe Biden had these documents for years, dating back to when he was a senator. Why were his counsel and others in his orbit looking for these documents around the time that Trump gets charged? So many questions there still to be answered, and I don't think her should be let off the hook in connection therewith. Transitioning to myself now on another kind of scandal and corruption pertaining to the deep state is the Republicans' investigation into the January 6th Select Committee. This is out of the House Administration Committee and the Oversight Subcommittee led by Barry Loudermilk of Georgia. So they've been looking into the politicization and weaponization, essentially, of the J6 Committee and also the security failures around January 6th, and released a report that hasn't gotten, I think, necessarily as much attention as it should have, because it's really the death knell of whatever shred of legitimacy and credibility that the January 6th Unselect Committee had. Now, we knew that committee, of course, was basically all Democrats and faux Republicans at best, that there was no adherence to House rules or principles of fairness or balance, that it was stage managed with TV executives hired to put on the show trials for the public to see, and that there was obviously a purely political retributive purpose with a preordained judgment from the committee, which was essentially Donald Trump, lead domestic terrorist, incited an insurrection, and you have to smear the entire Republican Party as being a bunch of insurrectionists or their neighbors. The committee, it's also worth noting, hoovered up personal information and communications of countless Americans. It compelled private companies to turn over that information. It probed conservative organizations and followed their money flows. It issued subpoenas against sitting members of Congress. And then, of course, it destroyed the concept of executive privilege, and it submitted criminal referrals to the Justice Department to carry out the jihad. So we knew all about that awfulness. The report underscores some of that awfulness, but it also shines light on some of the new revelations, some of which it's sort of filtered out in little crumbs, but which puts it together in one new big report on its initial findings on the J6 Unselect Committee. So one major takeaway is that the chair of that committee, Benny Thompson, obstructed Congress to the nth degree, despite his obligation to turn over everything, all the materials that committee produced. Thompson neither archived nor provided the Committee on House Administration the video recordings of all the witness interviews, up to 900 interview summaries or transcripts, over 1 terabyte of the 4 terabytes of data that they had, and 100, and they also deleted 100 documents or encrypted those documents, never provided the passwords to them. When Benny Thompson was asked to turn over the passwords, he said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." That's a direct quote. "I have no idea." The subcommittee also discovered that the committee concealed tons of exculpatory information, allowing to fester and propagating some of the most pernicious, salacious narratives about Republican complicity in the Capitol riot and unhinged behavior around it from, among others, President Trump. So for one thing, the select committee, remember, tried to create the appearance that House members who allowed for tours around January 6th were actually fostering reconnaissance efforts in advance of January 6th, preparing to stage an attack. Among those targeted and slandered was the chairman of this oversight subcommittee, Loudermilk, himself. But as the subcommittee reported, transcribed interviews of 2 participants in the tour that he organized made it clear the select committee knew there was nothing connecting Chairman Loudermilk's constituent tour to the events of January 6th. Despite this, they accused him of it. The public accusations led to death threats directed toward Chairman Loudermilk, his family, and his staff. While some of the individuals were at the tour were at the National Mall on January 6th, they never went into the Capitol. None of those individuals were charged. So that's one false narrative killed. Another false narrative regards President Trump and whether or not he called for there to be buttress security measures. In an interview that was never released with a White House employee, the committee actually acknowledges that he talked about allowing 10,000 National Guardsmen to come in and buttress in the Capitol Police, which has been a much debated detail about security measures talked about in advance. So if Donald Trump wanted to incite an insurrection, why was he calling for 10,000 National Guardsmen to be there to put down any potential disturbances or deter them? Also, the Oversight Subcommittee details that on January 3rd, several officials, including Acting Defense Secretary Miller and Chairman Milley of the Joint Chiefs, met with President Trump regarding the D.C. government's request for assistance in connection with January 6th. In the meeting, President Trump approved Miller's activating the D.C. National Guard to support law enforcement. Acting Secretary Miller told the president, "We've got a plan and we've got it covered." So then there's one other major bombshell that's been a lot of media focus, which is on the whole, Trump was incensed after he left the Ellipse. And then as the Capitol riot was coming, he grabbed the steering wheel from the Secret Service agent who was leading a motorcade and tried to direct it to the Capitol so he could participate in the riot. And then he lunged at another agent. And Cassidy Hutchinson was the star witness behind propagating this narrative, which she only divulged to the committee supposedly in the 4th transcribed interview that she participated in. But of course, this also falls apart under the scrutiny of this oversight subcommittee. It found that all of the witnesses, firsthand witnesses, the subcommittee did not talk to any of them for 4 months after Hutchinson herself participated in public hearings where she made the allegations. As it turns out, none of these firsthand witnesses corroborated what she said. She supposedly heard this story from President Trump's deputy chief of staff, Tony Ornato. In his interview, he directly refuted, according to the subcommittee, Hutchinson's testimony that she allegedly heard the story about what happened in the Beast, so-called the vehicle. Ornato testified that the first time he had ever heard the story Hutchinson claims that he had told her on January 6th was during Hutchinson's public testimony. Despite the driver of the president's SUV testifying under oath that the Hutchinson story was false, select committee chose to validate and promote Hutchinson's version of the story as fact. And of course, they hid all of this exculpatory evidence from Republicans and from the public. So the report also goes into a number of other things. The collusion with the committee with Fannie Willis, who apparently has seen materials that Republican members of Congress have not, that the select committee produced. It touches on some of the issues around the pipe bomber and the gallows that were put up and how none of these people have been identified, no suspects, et cetera. And it concludes, in many ways, the select committee functioned as a federal prosecutor, determined to make a case against President Trump. However, there was no cross-examination of the witnesses put forward by the select committee, no due process, no productive debate. So to me, this is sort of a fitting summation of what the regime means when it talks about our democracy, when it talks about justice. It's a wholly one-sided Soviet-style conception of it. Of course, this should make a bigger noise and impact than it has, I think, to date. But it kills a pivotal narrative, I think, and a salient one in the run-up to the 2024 election, especially when much of the lawfare is based on the J6 narrative that the committee helped foist on the public. So with that, I'm curious about what, if any, takeaways you might have from this report.
The major takeaway that I have is that, as we knew at the time when these hearings were taking place, this was more performance for the media than it was a serious investigation. The other thing that I take away from, besides Ben's points, is that the total lack of preparedness of the Capitol Police and of DC police writ large, which is actually kind of easy to explain if you know sort of the ebb and flow of protests in Washington, D.C. They're almost always left-leaning, and those left-leaning protests often erupt into violence, as we knew and saw all of the summer of 2020. But the right-wing protests, even when there are hundreds of thousands of people who come to the National Mall, so I can think of a few examples of that, the March for Life that happens every year. During the Tea Party days, there was quote unquote Million Man March that Glenn Beck led to the Mall of Tea Partiers, where there were hundreds of thousands of people. Those marches have been uniformly orderly and have not resulted in a lot of law breaking or a lot of like headaches for police. What happened on January 6th is a mob of right-wingers started to behave like a mob of left-wingers, and the police were completely unprepared to deal with that. And I don't want to completely downplay. I'm a law and order person. I think people who broke the law, who rioted in the U.S. Capitol, they deserve to feel the full force and the brunt of the law. But since then, what we've discovered is that, you know, at every turn, this riot, which followed an entire summer of riots, has been blown out of proportion and painted into an insurrection, or like the idea that the U.S. government was hanging by a thread, that I don't know, that like the QAnon shaman was going to be anointed emperor of America, you know, if it had continued for another 15 minutes. The comparisons to Pearl Harbor and 9/11, right? The vast disproportionate, like blowing out of proportion of this event. And then the actual factual discrepancies and the exculpatory material that has been hidden in this performance that was given to the media during these hearings that Ben has highlighted and this report shows to the public. I mean, it does show over and over again that it looks more and more like the excuse that the left needed to enact a lot of the not only censorship and interaction with social media companies that they were willing to do or itching to do, but also to use the apparatus of both law enforcement and intelligence services against their domestic opponents. And that's really what they've done. The FBI has been on it. You know, if somebody's great grandma, you know, peeked her nose into the Capitol on January 6th, that's a high priority for law enforcement. They're finding people still, you know, 4 years after the fact, right? Nearly 4 years after the fact. But, you know, all kinds of more serious things, both in the riots before that, you know, Molotov cocktails being thrown into cop cars, for example, right? And the very real deaths that happened during the riots of 2020, those things were not, they're not high on the priorities list of national law enforcement, of the FBI. So that's really the picture that emerges from here. This is more PR stunt than it is a serious attempt to, you know, deal with this riot as any like law and order nation, which we obviously are no longer, would deal with it.
Yeah, I think to me, this report is confirmation of the concerns that Republicans had with the makeup of this committee when it was first created. Which were that Republicans were apparently not going to have the same level of subpoena powers as Democrats, that Nancy Pelosi was able to veto Republican picks to actually sit on the committee. She only wanted her approved Republicans. And obviously the reason for that we now see is because they wanted to selectively present evidence and bury evidence that was inconvenient to their narrative that Trump was responsible for inciting an insurrection, and therefore had to be barred from ever running for office again. It was all part of this larger plan. And having any Republicans on that committee who were serious about finding the real reasons why this happened, And the failures of certain leaders who might have been Democratic in actually securing the Capitol that day would have been a way for this committee to be exposed for what it was, and they couldn't have that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the committee was a sham from the beginning for the reasons Amber just laid out and the ones that have been discussed entirely. I'm just really glad to see that we, you know, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger continue to get dunked on even after they're no longer in Congress. It's also a very good thing that they're not in Congress anymore. But with that, I'll move on to my topic, which is the TikTok ban. So literally, as we have been doing this podcast, the House had been voting on the question of whether or not TikTok should be forced to be divested from ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And the House voted overwhelmingly. I think if I have the number here, it was 352 to 65 in the House. And you know, there are bipartisan things that we think of as being part of the uniparty. And then there are bipartisan things where it's like, no, actually, this is really almost everybody in Congress, except for a few people. Only 15 Republicans said no. And really, it was more Democrats who were against it. And it's sort of, this kind of gets to another obvious problem here is, or obvious thing to talk about is that TikTok is a Democrat-dominated platform. Republicans have almost no presence on there at all, and Democrats have been running wild on it. And the fact that after a classified hearing last week, all of a sudden the Democrats, who had previously been shutting down attempts to ban TikTok and very skeptical of them in their own interest, are suddenly like, oh, we really actually do need to ban this. And so, you know, I am a pretty cynical person about, you know, when parties get together. In this case, I actually think that the Democrats really did get spooked by what they saw in that classified hearing. And it's not surprising. I mean, China has a law that says any company has to give all its data to the Chinese government if it's a Chinese company. TikTok's a Chinese company. It has an enormous amount of data on American citizens. And there's also a basic reciprocity argument here. China doesn't let X, Facebook, Instagram, any of our social media companies operate in China. They're a peer adversary of ours. Why should they be allowed to have their social media companies, you know, feed their algorithms into our country and then, it, you know, basically control how our children learn? That's insane. It's insane that we would allow it. It's not even a speech issue. It's a reciprocity issue. And there's not, I mean, I think the arguments of the libertarians are pretty fatuous. And, you know, the fact that you have like Rand Paul suddenly agreeing with AOC should be a tell-all. AOC is not a libertarian person, doesn't care about your freedom to speak at all, but she knows that she dominates on TikTok. She knows that she and her friends dominate on TikTok, and that's why they want to do it. There's also a disappointing aspect to all this, which is that there have been Republicans who have suddenly flip-flopped on TikTok and almost inexplicably outside of like donor motivations. And I don't like to call out these people, but Vivek is a really good example. When he was campaigning, Vivek was unbelievably anti-TikTok, called it fentanyl going to our children. And then all of a sudden now, after Trump sort of indicated some, you know, hedging on it, is like, oh, you know, well, we shouldn't ban TikTok, or we shouldn't force them to divest. It's not even a ban, it's just a forced divestment. I find their arguments to be extremely unpersuasive. There are other arguments that say that the bill itself will somehow give an expansion of power that will allow Biden to ban X or Rumble. One, I don't think that's true because people I trust who are very, very good on tech issues generally and are hostile to Facebook and Google say and pro X and pro free speech say that this bill won't do that, that this bill is pretty focused on platforms controlled by actual peer adversaries of the country. And second, they didn't propose amendments to like fix a tweak a problem here. They're trying to ultimately preserve TikTok. And I am very, very worried that basically people are enthralled to Jeff Yass, who is a major Republican donor, but also a guy who owns a $16 billion stake in TikTok. And he's out there donating huge amounts of money. You know, he met with Trump. He's donated a lot to Rand Paul. He's donated a lot to Vivek. And it just seems their positions seem very bizarre, very out of character, and it's hard to explain them in the absence of some external financial motivation. And I don't mean to be rude to them because I like these people, but it's just, it's, you know, you got to call it like you see it. So I'm curious what you guys think about the merits of this bill, but also like, what do you think is explaining the behavior of some Republicans who have previously been very anti-TikTok and are suddenly very skeptical of the government getting involved here?
So last week, when this bill was making its way through the Energy and Commerce Committee, which voted unanimously to send it to the full House for a vote, TikTok decided to engage in, I guess, election interference, if you want to put it that way, where they actually had pop-ups on everyone's, all the users' apps, telling them to call their congressperson. And they had the users actually put their zip codes in so that they could direct them to their congressperson's phone number. And I talked to some staffers last week who said, yeah, these kids are calling us and threatening to kill themselves if we take away their TikTok, or threatening to kill the people in our office. So that it was a combination of suicide threats and death threats going across the Congress. I ran into someone at Capitol Hill Club who said, yeah, I'm taking all of my interns out for drinks tonight, because they had to field thousands of these insane calls from teenagers who can't even vote, by the way. But we're saying that they were going to not vote for them if they took away TikTok. And it was kind of a cell phone by TikTok, right? Because here we are debating the fact that a foreign adversary has a massive influence and manipulation tool for American children. And they demonstrated it perfectly by showing that if we try to do something about it, they're going to unleash a child army of depressed, anxious teens onto the Congress. So it was like the perfect argument for exactly why TikTok should be banned. And I think it's worth pointing out too, based, you know, in response to the merits of this bill and some of the arguments against this bill, that China does not even allow the TikTok that we see in America in its own country. Because they are very intentionally manipulating algorithms in order to divide American society. Like, it's everything that the libs warned about in terms of Russia and Facebook, but like actually being done in a very subversive and manipulative and creepy way by China, who's notoriously very good at these kind of psyop campaigns, not to mention the issues with spying and national security and everything else that I'm sure was in that briefing in Congress. So I'm glad to see this bill proceed. I'm also disturbed by the arguments against it. I think a lot of it does have to do with financial or influence motivation. Pretty much every Republican I've heard defended is someone who's pretty active on the app and probably makes money from it or is actively invested in it. And it sucks to see that you know, people supposedly on our side are that easily manipulated as well. But I mean, it's politics, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing that happens. You can't trust anybody, really.
Yeah, I mean, I share the disappointment in some of these folks and agree with Will's characterization, Trump and Vivek in particular. It's really hard to square what they've said in the past with what they're saying now, which makes it especially suspect when you change your mind about something like this after meeting with a major donor who has a personal stake in it. It's hard to characterize. Again, I don't want to cast aspersions, but it's hard to characterize that or imagine that it has like that doesn't have an influence. And again, that is disappointing. The push notifications were even more aggressive, I think, just to add to what Amber said. Users weren't allowed to use the app until they had, like, it was very difficult to get rid of the push notifications. You really had to like click through a lot of things to get out of it. So like in order to get to your TikTok crack, you had to call Congress. I think, as Amber said, rightly, I think it really demonstrated counterproductively for TikTok, how easily, you know, this kind of, like force, and the addiction among American teens to this app could be weaponized, on behalf of the company, in this case, and like self-interested on behalf of the company, but easily one could imagine it, being used for something that simply the CCC wanted to be passed. Right. So they really did sort of shoot themselves in the foot in that. The main objection outside of, suspicious flips from some people on this, has been that it will empower one of the domestic companies that is also spying on Americans and collecting data on Americans and censoring Americans. And that's all true. But that's an argument for thinking about further regulation in the tech space more broadly. That's not an argument against making sure that at bare minimum, the government of a hostile foreign power doesn't have this kind of power into the minds and hearts of a large chunk of American youth. So yeah, I'm open to, as Will said, if people want to propose amendments to ensure that this bill is not used for something that it's not intended to down the line, as is a problem with any legislation, I'm open to those arguments. But what I'm mostly seeing are sort of disappointing arguments that amount to either I very suspiciously changed my mind on this in the last, you know, week because I've met with Jeff Yass, or amount to basically saying, well, I don't want to give extra bennies. I don't want to give any upside to American tech companies because they're also evil. Yes, but there's still a distinction between American companies and the CCP. So yeah, I'm with Will and Amber on this.
So I'll comment on the merits briefly. If this bill does what it says it intends to do, then that would be, to me, no doubt a good for America. TikTok is obviously a Chinese Communist Party asset. It's for propagandizing, for surveilling, targeting Americans and others with psyops. And to the extent it's out of Chinese Communist Party hands, that's a great thing. Obviously, we can talk about the corrosive effects of these apps more broadly. As Amber sort of alluded to with the freak out, the meltdown that occurred, which I think maybe validates the idea that this really will kill TikTok as a CCP asset if ultimately this passes the Senate and then survives the legal onslaught that surely the CCP effectively will wage in defense of it. All that said, I am nervous and skeptical, first of all, about how the Uniparty sort of settled on this and seemingly very quickly, because there were other bills that had emerged in prior Congresses to deal with this, where there were definite red flags. I'm thinking of the Restrict Act, for example, as one that was in the Senate last year, and I wrote about that, and I wrote about some of my suspicions about how this could easily be used to target an X. And, you know, this bill as written to me seems like it's a little bit harder to do that. Always and everywhere when it comes to the censorship regime, they try to use the threat of foreign adversaries to then target domestic actors. We saw that in the censoring of Wrongthink and Mass in 2020 and beyond, and the creation of, you know, essentially the Wrongthink police within the federal government, targeting Americans accordingly, directly and by proxy. So, you know, how would you twist the language in this bill? They talk about, you know, covered applications that have foreign control, and they'd have to find a way to say that either some of the investors in X or Elon Musk himself are essentially controlled assets of the Chinese Communist Party, and thus there's this national security rationale to target X. Hopefully the language can't be twisted and abused in such a way. But I think it's always worth being skeptical and suspicious about how the censorship regime will use anything and everything to target Wrongthink. But again, there are people who are good on these issues. I agree with Will that say that's not going to occur here. So I pray to God they're right to the extent this bill ultimately does survive. Maybe there's language that can be added to strengthen it. I will say on the con side, Sean Davis has a pretty compelling thread about basically this isn't about the hearts of the American government being in the right place. It's about wanting to turn TikTok into a U.S. intelligence and national security apparatus asset like all the other platforms except Twitter/X. That may be the case. I guess you can make the argument that it's better that it's in the control of our national security apparatus than the Chinese Communist Party's. These are two pretty bad alternatives altogether. But in any event, again, bottom line, if the bill does what it says it's going to do, great, but always I think it's worth being cynical and suspicious about how ultimately this kind of legislation can be used to target free-thinking apps or relatively robust enablers, facilitators of free speech in America. And so we should be suspicious, skeptical, and ask hard questions about it.
And now we're going to pop over to Inez to break down the recent DEI issues with the CHIPS Act.
Yeah, speaking of bills that were sold to us by the Uniparty, whether that applies to the TikTok bill or not, it definitely applies to the CHIPS Act. If you recall, this is something big accomplishment of the Biden administration, touted as a bipartisan bill with all the usual suspects in the Senate, you know, Mitt Romney, Lindsey Graham, and of course, Leader McConnell, all in favor of this $39 billion bill, basically for grants for U.S. semiconductor to lure more manufacturing of semiconductors. Obviously, this is a problem when we consider that the vast majority of semiconductor manufacturing happens in Taiwan, which is obviously a dicey geopolitical situation. It's entirely possible that China will attempt to take over Taiwan, which would be not only obviously a major, World War III potential spark, but also would give China access to the vast majority of this crucial manufacturing, both skill and like materials, which is not a good thing, not only for the West, not only for America, but for the entire West. So that's what the CHIPS Act was intended to hedge against, right? To encourage more semiconductor manufacturing in the United States to kind of counterbalance the reliance that we currently have on Taiwan, given its position in the world. Sounds like a pretty decent idea, right? You can understand why some Republicans would go along with a Democratic bill like this. Even to me myself, this sounds pretty good. But then this is how it's actually turned out. And this is why our regime, it's just like the reason I wanted to do this as my segment is because it's such an encapsulation of how unserious our regime actually is and how it's unable to lay aside some of the ideological woke concerns, even when it's clearly something, a matter of national security and really, really important for the United States on the world stage. So, basically companies are not reacting to these huge pot of money as we would expect them to react. So Taiwan, semiconductor manufacturing company, the one that is in Taiwan but is now building factories elsewhere, it's pushed back its second Arizona factory, planned Arizona factory. Samsung has delayed its Texas factory. Intel has halted moves towards opening a factory in Columbus, Ohio, and respectively that the Taiwanese company is now looking at building in Japan. The Samsung is building in South Korea, and then Intel is looking at building in Poland, Israel, potentially Ireland, right? And some of these countries, unlike the United States, are also contiguous to wars. And so that's apparently, even with that kind of threat, is preferable to building in the United States. So why is that? Well, because this money isn't moving. And the reason it isn't moving is because there are a ton of provisions, both in the language of the law itself and in the way that that language has been interpreted by the Biden administration agencies, to attach all kinds of impossible DEI strings to this money. So some of the 19 sections that are aimed at helping underrepresented minorities in the bill include all kinds of requirements for hiring and for contracting with minority-owned businesses, hiring women in proportions where they simply don't exist in manufacturing. So, for example, in construction, women only make up about 10% of people in skilled construction, but this bill requires that companies hire a higher proportion of women than exists in the current market. There are training issues going on with, like, essentially this bill does not allow these companies to hire the skilled workforce that they need to hire to do this kind of very high-end manufacturing, and doesn't allow them the freedom to like hire the people who would actually be easily trained for this work, doesn't allow them any kind of leeway in building these factories. It's like building something very technical and difficult in a faculty lounge with all kinds of insane DEI requirements attached to it. So the end result of all of this, of course, is that this money either isn't moving. These companies are building outside of the United States, which, look, it's definitely better that we have semiconductor capacity in, you know, Poland or Israel or Ireland or South Korea or Japan than it is that it's in Taiwan. But I mean, why wouldn't it be here in the United States and we passed money to this effect to try to make this happen, and we have shot ourselves in the foot with these absolutely stupid DEI regulations. So the end result of all of this, which, by the way, again, Republicans, a lot of Republicans voted for, and not only did they vote for this, they didn't even exercise their power, right? Especially in the Senate, you need those 60 votes. They didn't even exercise their negotiating power to strip some of these BS provisions out of the CHIPS Act, right? And now the end result of all of this is the kind of things that are actually getting money from the CHIPS Act is like $15 million to ASU for their climate change project. That apparently qualifies for these grants that are intended to bring a crucial form of national security related manufacturing home to the United States. And that's like sort of the end result of this bill. I think it's very demonstrative of where we're at as a country and how we're not going to be able to compete on the global stage or to be sort of the hegemon that we have been if we continue to bend to this absolutely ludicrous ideology that is eating us from within. But with that, I'll turn it out to you guys for comment.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating case study, Inez, and thank you for laying it out the way that you did. I found that one of my biggest frustrations with the Trump administration was that he had a lot of Buy American policies that landed on his desk that he didn't end up signing, or potential executive action that he could have taken that he didn't. And then you had Biden sort of hijack that language and steal the phrase Buy American and try to implement his own versions of these policies. And while initially you would think, oh, he's deserving of credit for that because he did move to reshore manufacturing that Trump might not have, but it's really the case that the devil is in the details, and it doesn't do us a whole lot of good trying to bring these key industries back to the United States if we're not going to take it seriously and actually allow companies to hire the workers that are best suited to create these key items, whether it's chips or pharmaceuticals or medical supplies. We're really just preventing ourselves from being competitive on the global stage and continuing the degradation and destruction of the middle class by allowing manufacturing to be made by our enemies.
Go ahead, Ben. I don't have thoughts on this one.
Okay, well, I'll be brief. Beyond the obvious takeaway that pervasive wokeism just corrupts everything it touches, and of course, the headlines always being ultimately undermined about what legislation is actually supposed to do by the devil and the details of the rules and regulations that ultimately govern them. And I guess we could talk about the administrative state corruption here as well in connection with the CHIPS Act. I think what this underscores to me is how hard it would be to actually effectuate an industrial policy in this country, given the regime that would be overseeing that policy. So even if it was crafted properly, and even if it dealt with already the concerns around, you know, the economic inefficiency of and graft and corruption that would be baked into any sort of national manufacturing program, which we arguably need to be able to compete with communist China and a whole slew of other adversaries, to be able to make the components of essential technologies and weaponry, et cetera, so that we're not reliant on anyone else for these critical tools of modern life. How can we imagine that we could execute it given what you see in just a piece of legislation like this? And to me, that's just incredibly disturbing and disconcerting. You know, obviously there are ways to fast track production of things. There are ways to get around government red tape and restrictions. But I think this shows essentially, again, the self-righteously suicidal nature of the West. We know there are things that we need to do to be able to prosper and survive, and we're willing to essentially die and literally sacrifice ourselves at the altar of DEI and wokeism. And it's hard to know how the West ultimately survives when these seeds of destruction among our elites are just so pervasive. And again, we ultimately prioritize these purported, you know, virtuous principles over actually doing what's necessary to survive and thrive.
We're going to move over to final thoughts. Will, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, my final thoughts on Israel. We see some reporting that's saying that Biden is trying to essentially force Netanyahu out, that apparently there's a U.S. intelligence estimate that says he might not survive this, and that Biden is still extremely angry with Netanyahu and wants a government led by Benny Gantz and some more liberal people. I think, one, it's obnoxious that we're intervening and meddling in their political affairs at the moment, that we're meddling in their political affairs when they're in the middle of a serious war. But two, it also just is a massive misreading of the Israeli public. The Israeli public is supportive of the war aims outlined by Netanyahu. They don't have a different view on what ought to be done in Gaza or in Rafah. And it's sort of the Democrat, they do an inverse of this, like, oh, well, you know, there's this other block in Israel that agrees with us here in the United States. And it's like, no, not really, not among more than 20% of the Israeli public. 80% is behind the war. And so it's dishonest and obnoxious. And I really do hope that the Biden administration knocks it off and just lets Israel finish its job.
Well, you know, I said from the start after October 7th that quickly the bear hug of the Biden administration would likely turn into a mauling with respect to Israel. And, you know, we also see now not only the overt talk about toppling Bibi, but there was a whisper campaign dating back several months on this about how Bibi wouldn't ultimately survive post October 7th. The administration, of course, was in part behind and certainly supportive of the near civil war tenor that ultimately exploded in Israel and destabilized Israel prior to October 7th with respect to judicial reform. And basically, you have the Trump derangement syndrome cohort in Washington solely talking to the Bibi derangement syndrome faction in Israel, and that's validating and reinforcing the administration's own inclinations, which are to put the screws to Israel, not only in service of the, as someone called it, the two-state solution here of needing to win the uncommitted votes in Michigan and Minnesota, the Dearborn nominal or marginal voter, but also, as I've long argued, because the anti-Israel policy is part and parcel of the Iran first policy. Israel is the biggest deterrent to Iran, and all of the administration's coddling and appeasing of Iran is also consistent with trying to get in a more left-wing government in Israel and ultimately to form a Palestinian terrorist state essentially surrounding Israel. And the whole slew of policies that the administration is pushing, including now Biden talking openly about conditioning weapon sales on Israeli conduct. So I think it's worth noting, though, that the focus of the ire on Bibi is in some ways a nod to Democrats domestically who may loathe him. But to Will's point, the polling in Israel and in America, by the way, simply does not support the administration's policies. Overwhelmingly, their support for destroying Hamas in Israel, overwhelmingly their support for Israel's cause in the U.S., which is in the national interest of the U.S. because a strong Israel, again, is the biggest deterrent to jihadism and savagery ultimately in the Middle East. And of course, the administration tries to argue that, well, this is about essentially turning October 7th into a peace process where you reward Hamas with a Hamas Fatah terror-led terrorist state, rejuvenated, so-called, a revitalized Palestinian Authority leading it. But we had the Abraham Accords, which were accords that were inked when Israel was strong and Iran was weak. Now we have the exact opposite, and somehow the Biden administration people are going to argue that that's somehow going to lead to peace in the Middle East. It's obviously farcical. It's an immense betrayal. It's a betrayal that I've been talking about here for some time. And the only possible silver lining to this effort of the Biden administration to constrain in every single way Israel and try to destabilize the government in the middle of a war is that, if anything, Bibi's strength might actually be coalescing. The coalition behind Bibi has actually added a new member recently, which may enter the war cabinet there as well. So inadvertently, the Biden administration may be strengthening Bibi and his coalition by attacking him, but they're still doing everything they possibly can to split it, including, as we've talked about before, that executive order basically extending the war on wrong thing to Israel, where they're sanctioning, they've threatened to sanction everyone, including elected officials, including ministers on the right who dare in any way go against the Biden administration's policy with respect to Judea and Samaria, which the Biden administration refers to as the West Bank. So all of this is a way of saying the Iran first policy is and has been afoot as predicted here. But the only positive that can be seen from the perspective of Western civilization ultimately is that it may actually be strengthening Israel's resolve. The question is, however, will they, under these constraints, go into Rafah and destroy ultimately the final Hamas strongholds? And then what comes after that, and what kind of rupture is this going to create? At what point does the U.S. use the leverage of weapons against Israel and move from beyond potential conditioning to making those conditions impossible for Israel to meet? And we're getting pretty close to that point. We'll see ultimately where the administration goes. If the domestic pressure intensifies on the administration to stop stabbing Israel on the back, and ultimately what kind of resolve Israel shows, with, of course, a war looming in the north. And the last point I'll make on that is, while the administration talks all about the suffering Palestinian Arabs who had elected Hamas in Gaza and who overwhelmingly have provided material support to Hamas on October 7th and then subsequently, and Palestinian Arabs who overwhelmingly support what occurred on October 7th and Hamas specifically, as well as Fatah, there are tens of thousands of Israelis who are refugees in their own country displaced, in no small part because of the Biden administration policy to prevent Israel from striking and obliterating Hezbollah to the north. There's zero talk domestically or internationally about those refugees. And it speaks to the inherent double standard here.
I will close with, sorry, Inez. I guess I'll continue, but I was going to talk about the ban on prescribing puberty blockers by England's National Health Service. This is basically the confirmation of an interim policy that was proposed a few months ago, where a review of the prescription of puberty blockers for children suffering from gender dysphoria who are confused about their gender was found that these so-called treatments are not evidence-based, that the prescription of puberty blockers is not any better than a wait-and-see method for allowing children to resolve their gender dysphoria by growing up and going through puberty and just allowing their bodies to develop naturally. It also found, quite interestingly, that contrary to a common refrain from the pro-trans left, that children, that it's not a good policy to say that children can just get on puberty blockers while they decide what they want their gender to be. And then if they ultimately opt out of a full transition, that there will be no consequences. They found one that, yes, there are long-term consequences of being on puberty blockers for a certain period of time, especially if you're suppressing it beyond the point of when your natural puberty is supposed to occur. This is far different from prescribing puberty blockers for precocious puberty. And then two, that these have the effect of basically locking kids into a transition. So once you start this supposed treatment path, you're basically ensuring that someone is going to continue on to hormone therapy, et cetera, and you're giving away the opportunity for children to desist if they end up growing out of their gender dysphoria. So a lot of interesting research went into this. The woman, Hillary Cass, who was charged with doing this investigation and looking at the available data and research, obviously did a fantastic job and came to the right conclusion. Now it's just up to the United States to follow suit, because of course they were the ones who followed Europe from the Dutch model of so-called affirming therapy for children with gender dysphoria. Now they should follow the research that shows that this was not evidence-based to begin with. But unfortunately in the United States, we have this really uphill battle because the NHS is obviously a state-run health service. In the US, we have a much more fractured health policy. And one of the biggest challenges is that our medical institutions are really controlled by two major factors, one of which is big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, which makes a lot of money on this. And then two, the medical professional associations, which have largely, with the exception of a few dissenters, come to the conclusion that the right treatment path for children who have gender dysphoria is to immediately put them on puberty blockers and then follow through with hormone therapy and sex changes. So I think it's going to be a lot harder for the United States to come to a cohesive policy against the so-called gender-affirming model than it was for England to reach that conclusion. And of course, we also have to see that other parts of the UK will, if they will follow through with this as well, because right now it's just England. The rest of the UK still will allow the prescription of puberty blockers. And then one final quick point is that this decision does still allow for puberty blockers to be prescribed in clinical research settings. So they're still basically leaving the door open for some children to be treated like lab rats for the sake of them gathering more evidence, when I think that the evidence that we have right now is overwhelming enough to say that these things should be gotten rid of completely for the purposes of transgender quote-unquote care.
My final thought is touching on the interview that Biden gave after the State of the Union. Obviously during the State of the Union, he didn't apologize in this interview for calling Lincoln Riley, but he did apologize for calling her murderer and illegal. He corrected himself. It's undocumented, and that's apparently the most important thing that he needs to apologize for in that incident and in his State of the Union speech. This is, of course, sticking the thumb in the eye once again, not only to Lincoln Riley's family, but also to all Americans who are concerned about the consequences and the crime that is coming from people who shouldn't even be in this country. We talked about this issue more broadly last NatCon, but I wanted to highlight the sort of callousness of Biden towards this issue. It also kind of puts the kibosh on the idea that this issue is so unpopular that the Biden administration might actually take some steps and put in place some of the policies that the Trump administration had in place to quench or slow down the absolute tsunami on our southern border. He did go down to the border, and that would have been an opportune time to announce those kinds of policies. But it seems like, as we talked about at the time, the fact that Mitch McConnell handed the Democrats such a PR victory with this absolutely terrible bill, but nevertheless, allowed Biden, which he did in his State of the Union address, to get away with basically blaming Republicans, saying they wanted a campaign issue and we were going to fix it with this bill, when we talked about it here. The bill was not going to fix the issue at all. But giving him that political fig leaf, it seems like that has actually taken the place in the Biden administration, taking the place of any actual substantive reversal on some of these policies. In fact, if anything, he's going full steam in the opposite direction. We discovered this week that actually apparently the administration is just flying planes full of migrants all over the United States, skipping the border. So they're taking some pressure off the border by just skipping that entire thing for some migrants and just flying them directly into a variety of U.S. cities where they will receive sanctuary city policies, like in my own New York City. There's no indication that the polls on this issue, which are overwhelmingly in favor of Trump on the subject, are actually going to force the Biden administration to make some concessions here. If anything, the policies are going the opposite direction, and the rhetoric, the fig leaf to cover it, is the one that was handed to Biden by the establishment Republicans in the Senate. So just no good news to end on that subject.
Thanks, everybody. And on behalf of Will, Inez, and Ben, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Amber Duke, and we will see you at the next NatCon Squad.